So hi, everyone. I'm Jake Weiss. I'm a postdoc with Heidi at RPI, or at least for the next few weeks I will be. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about my thesis work, and then I'm going to continue on and tell you a little bit about some new work that an undergraduate's been doing at RPI in conjunction with me and Heidi, looking at following up the work that I did as for my thesis. So this is all going to revolve around some new streams I found using statistical photometric parallax and Milky Way at home. So just a quick overview. I'm going to start by talking about fitting the halo stellar density using Milky Way at home. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Milky Way at home, how it works, and then go from there. A little bit about our density model as well. And then I'm going to talk about exploring some of the new streams that we found in Virgo using six-dimensional phase space from Gaia and some Quest R Lyres. And then we're going to talk about putting those pieces together and then talking about something that we've dubbed the Virgo radial merger, but could end up having one of many names in the end. So here's the stereotypical field of streams type picture. This one's from Grillmeyer and Carlin in 2016. It's a little more up to date. It has some, definitely not all of the streams in the north. As we know, that changes on about a weekly basis. So we're going to mainly focus on the Sagittarius North Bright, faint, or the bifurcated stream, whatever you choose to call it, and then the Virgo overdensity here. As a little bit of spoiler, these are the new streams, or one of the new streams, and then the parallel stream, which is sort of a follow-up on the Virgo stellar stream and the parallel stream from Tony Soane in, I believe, 2016. So I guess one of the other things I should say before I leave this slide is that what we're going to be doing is slicing this picture up in the wedges that they were originally surveyed in. So going across like this to try and piecewise fit the density in our model for each stripe. This is going to give us independent fits to all of the streams in each stripe, and then we're going to try and build up the picture of all the streams in the end from all of those individual fits. So here is some background about Milky Way at home. I know there were a few questions earlier about the users that we have and sort of what our actual computational power is and how much fraction of the time we actually get to run on people's computers. So basically what Milky Way at home is, it's a massive distributed volunteer computing network where people donate their unused computer cycles at home to our scientific calculations. We basically farm out our likelihood calculations for our optimization problems to all of these people across the world. Here you can see that we're actually located on all continents except for Antarctica, with users pretty much everywhere. And I believe almost every UN sanctioned or recognized nation. More than every UN recognized nation. We do this using the Berkeley Open Infrastructure for Network Computing. Really easy to use, makes getting our software delivered out to our users really easy, and takes care of a lot of the middleware part of interfacing with all of our users. We have currently 20,000 active volunteers. On any given day, we're receiving results from about 7,000 of them. And we have about 30,000 active computers. Again, based on this ratio, you can expect to see about 10,000 computers returning results to us on any given day. This gives us a computing power equivalent to one petaflop. This is only used for our projects, so our density fitting and n-body projects. So we don't have to share it with anyone. It's purely used for these optimization problems. And this petaflop is sort of an average computational power based on if you ask how much computing power does it take to do a single work unit, and then you look at all of the work units we receive in a day, it tells you that we get a petaflop worth of computational power. So this does fluctuate on a daily basis, but this is pretty average. So now let's look at what our density model actually looks at. And we look at these individual stripes where you can see some kind of smooth underlying density profile and then these variations in that density like that, these two here. Those are pretty much the Sagittarius and its bifurcated companion, we believe, or maybe there's Virgo kind of smearing things out as well in there. So these are all main sequence turnoff stars. This is the density of main sequence turnoff stars in a given bin. And we have three major coordinates that we can kind of try and locate the streams in for their stream centers in this view. And that's the radial distance from the sun. So this is a heliocentric plot. And then its great circle angular coordinate mu. There's also a third dimension, which allows you to deviate from that great circle. We'll call that nu. It's just an angle off of that great circle. So why do we need to use this statistical photometric parallax that I mentioned earlier? So basically, when you're looking at main sequence turnoff stars, you don't have a single population with a single absolute magnitude. Instead, you have kind of a spread or a range of absolute magnitudes that goes across about two magnitudes in their absolute magnitude. So what we have to do is build up some stellar density model that we believe will match our data, and then convolve it with this magnitude distribution, and then match that with our data using some maximum likelihood method at the end. And you can see why this is so important if you just look at PAL-5, for example, which is a globular cluster. You can imagine that it should be pretty much all at the same distance, and in fact, you see that it's spread out over, like I said, two magnitudes. So this is just kind of a proof of concept. You can see it all the way back from 2002 in Newberg's paper. In this plot, you can also see some of the other features, the Virgo overdensity / Virgo stellar stream, Sagittarius, Hercules Aquila in the south, and some other things. So how do we model this absolute magnitude distribution? Originally, we were just using some Gaussian model for the distribution, 0.6 standard deviation, really, really simple model. And it works pretty well. Back in Newbie 2013, this is what they used, and they did actually fit Sagittarius reasonably well, came out with about the same answer that Velikarov did in 2006 for the stream centers, and then he was able to come up with some stream density profile just for Sagittarius. And then in 2011, he went and he actually modeled globular clusters in the halo to try and figure out a better idea for what the absolute magnitude distribution for these main sequence turnoff stars are when you take into account the selection function from SDSS. So this is the detection efficiency and then the actual selection of main sequence turnoff stars given the color errors in the SDSS. And you end up with this more complicated model, which is no longer symmetric. It's a two-half Gaussian model where you have some constant standard deviation on the left and some varying standard deviation on the right, which basically accounts to faint stars leaking into and out of your selection bin for your main sequence turnoff due to the color errors that I mentioned earlier. And now you might ask, well, how does age and metallicity kind of contribute to what this absolute magnitude distribution should look like for stars in the halo? And basically what we find is that all of the globular clusters that we looked at, or what that newbie looked at in 2011, kind of fall along this age-metallicity relationship here. And as long as you have your populations falling on this age-metallicity relationship, they kind of conspire with each other to ensure that your absolute magnitude for the turnoff of your stars remains approximately constant. So you don't have to worry about the age or metallicity of your stars. This is pretty much a blanket statement for all of the stars in the halo. You can say that they follow this absolute magnitude distribution. And that's the assumption we make going into this. So now, what is our actual absolute or our density model for the stellar halo? What we do is we build up a Hernquist plus exponential thick disk for the smooth background component of each of these wedges. And we allow it to fit two parameters for this. So one is going to be your flattening of your Hernquist, and the other is going to be the fraction of stars that you expect to see in the Hernquist part of the background versus the thick disk part of the background. We fix the scale height and the scale length of the exponential thick disk to the same parameters that were used in the Xu et al. 2015 paper, I believe. I'm not quite sure where they got their scale heights and widths or lengths from. And then we have three streams that we fit per wedge, and each of these streams is going to have six parameters. So it's going to have two parameters that describe where the stream center is in the wedge. So that's going to be your mu and your r. We're going to just assume that everything is centered at nu equals zero because it's sort of a degenerate parameter, and it's going to make things a little bit easier. And then we have two more parameters that describe the orientation of your stream, your Gaussian cylinder, in your wedge. So that's just going to be two angles. And then we have another parameter that describes the Gaussian width. So for a Gaussian cylinder, you're going to have some fall off that's going to be described based on what the standard deviation of the Gaussian is, or your distance is from the center line of the cylinder. And then the final thing that we're going to have is basically something that amounts to the fraction of stars we expect to see in this stream versus the other streams and your halo. So we call it the weight of this stream. And then when you take all of this together, you have three streams times six parameters plus two parameters gives you 20 parameters per stripe that we're fitting. So this is quite the feat to try and fit 20 parameters for 100,000 stars per stripe across, I think we did 12 different stripes in the north. So it's a big problem, and that's why we need to use Milky Way at home. So now let's talk about some of the results of this. I don't want to bore you with any of the math that is the actual implementation of the density model. So what we get out after we fit all of these streams across the entire North Galactic Cap is that the average halo flattening is about 0.6, with a dispersion across all of the stripes of 0.04. So we're pretty confident in this number that we have a reasonable estimate for what we think the flattening is if you assume that you have some Hernquist. And then you simultaneously fit all of the streams, and whatever is left over outside of those streams, it has this flattening. And we are also pretty confident that we have about 50% of the stars in our stripes are in this background component. So this smooth background makes up a lot of the stars. As you can see, for this particular stripe, it's closer to 45% with about 40,000 stars. So now I'm going to talk about some of the actual stream results. So for each of the streams, you can see that I've plotted on here a stream center. It's this blue dot. And then there's also, which you may not be able to see on this projector, a white little arrow that describes the orientation of the stream. And so what we did is we looked at all of these points, and we kind of cross-referenced these points with known substructure, both in this dimension and in RA and distance dimension, to try and understand which one of these streams, or which one of these centers belong to which streams. And when we do that, we end up with a diagram that looks something like this. So you have here Sagittarius in red. You can see that there are some stripes that we don't fit it too well. That might have to do with maybe not fitting enough streams in those stripes or some other factors. And then you can see we also fit, for some streams, the bifurcated stream. This other thing that seems to be centered around a globular cluster but is much too wide to be a stream from a globular cluster. The Sagittarius trailing tail in the north, which we find is around 100 kiloparsecs. I'll show you that in a minute. And then this parallel stream and perpendicular stream. So this parallel stream is about a distance of 15 kiloparsecs away and is consistent with something being in Virgo. We cross-referenced this parallel stream with the Virgo stellar stream, as well as a stream from Tony Sohn's paper where he looked at Hubble Space Telescope proper motions and found a stream that had a very similar proper motion to, or in the direction that follows the stream. And this is consistent with both the Virgo stellar stream and the parallel stream. And the name we picked is pretty arbitrary between which one we wanted to call it. It's consistent with both. This perpendicular stream, though, there was no literature or anything out at the time that described what this stream was. So this is the first instance of us discovering something new using this method. Now when we go and we look at this in RA and magnitude, or RA and distance, or log distance, I guess, you see that this perpendicular stream is all at one distance. So we were pretty confident saying that we have one distance for the stream, and it stretches pretty far across the sky, which is a pretty interesting result. And then the parallel stream as well follows pretty much a single distance here. Again, at that 15 kiloparsecs, right where you expect to see something big and fluffy like Virgo. If you were to look at the widths of these streams, which I don't have on my slides, you find that these are actually quite wide features and might be consistent with something that might be a shell or something that blew up. Then we have Sagittarius, which we can see fits pretty well with the Belikov 2006 results, and the bifurcated stream, which again also fits pretty well with the Belikov and 2006 results. So we can be pretty confident that at least the substructure that we're fitting is fitting pretty well. Out here you can see the Sagittarius trailing tail, which The uncertainties on here I do not have included, but they are quite large for this. So you can imagine for main sequence turnoff stars going out to 100 kiloparsecs, you're looking at something that's getting really faint. So we don't have a lot of data out here, so our uncertainties are about 20 kiloparsecs in the stream centers for the distance for these things. That also has some correlation to its RA uncertainty as well. So as soon as I had this published and I ran into Vasily out in Shanghai, he mentioned that he had also seen something very similar to this perpendicular stream in RR Lyrae stars. And he independently kind of confirmed that this perpendicular stream does seem to exist. So this was extremely satisfying to know that some new structure that we had found was then independently confirmed from another source in another tracer, which was really, really interesting. He attributes this to being part of the LMC and SMC, but didn't really do any kinematic follow-up to these RR Lyraes in his paper. So we're going to, in fact, suggest maybe a different source for this substructure. And what we're basically going to do is now start looking at these two new substructure, well, the one new substructure in the parallel stream or the Virgo Stellar stream in a little bit more detail. So what we did is we went to some of the previous literature on the Virgo overdensity, and we looked at sort of the motivation behind what the Virgo overdensity is, and you know, it was originally found in this Dufo 2006 paper where she found some Virgo Stellar stream, and then Newberg in 2007 found this two-horned kind of excess over what you would imagine was maybe a Gaussian halo model. And from there, there was some moving groups found by Dufo in 2014, and significantly more moving groups found in Vivas 2016. And through all of this, no one really had any kind of clear picture of what was going on here. There was just a ton of moving groups all in one area. There was stuff going out, stuff coming in line of sight velocity, and it was sort of a mess. So we're hoping that through this analysis, we can kind of build a more coherent picture of what's going on here. So we take, starting with these Dufo 2014 moving groups, we look at these now cross-matched with the Gaia catalog, and we come up with RA distance, RA deck, and then velocities in VXVY and VXVZ space. And we start looking at whether or not these moving groups that she found in line of sight velocity remain moving groups and which parts stay in the moving groups when you start looking with now Gaia proper motions. So you can see here the diamonds are the ones that we decided by eye looked like they still belonged to a moving group. And then these circles here are the ones that we said were probably no longer part of the moving group when you start taking into account these other dimensions. So we can see that for the most part, Donlin et al., which is the new paper that has all of this in it, which we just recently submitted, finds that a good fraction of these stars actually do remain in the moving groups. I should mention that when we did cross-match this to Gaia, we had about a 90 or 95% cross-match rate, so most of the stars in the original moving groups actually did have companions in Gaia, which is good. So then we decided to look at these in you know, the typical radial velocity versus rotational velocity plots that have become all the rage recently, as well as energy and angular momentum, and then some other angular momentum coordinates just because. Here you can see that these moving groups all have very little rotational velocity and are on very radial orbits. So we're suggesting that maybe this is some very radial substructure similar to the sausage which was found originally in the solar neighborhood and the Gaia-Enceladus merger. Here we look at the distributions of energy and angular momenta. You can see that this thing has a very large distribution of energies and not a very large distribution of angular momentum, which is also very interesting. And here we can see that one of the little parts of this moving group here, these yellow squares, are very different in LX to LY, And when you actually plot these four particular stars and fit an orbit to them, it does not seem to be related to the Virgo overdensity. Instead, it seems to be related to another stream which is well known, which is the Cocytus stream that was found in a recent Grillmeyer paper. So we ended up cutting this out of our final sample as well. So we decided to start fitting orbits to all of these moving groups independently. And when we did that, we found that if you did group A and B separately, it didn't work so well. And I guess one of the things I should mention specifically is that if you look back here, group A and B have velocities that are opposite in direction. So one is going out specifically in radial velocity and coming back on the other side of radial velocity. So this is sort of consistent with the picture that we had with the two horns of Virgo. And if we fit this with a single orbit, which we found we were able to do, you could end up having something that is going through apogalactic and coming back on itself, and you end up with sort of this radial structure that comes out and it goes out and then comes back in. So that's what we have here in our first sort of orbit and n-body simulation. We can see that this orbit is consistent with all of these points here, which are the groups A and B. And then we also have group H plotted on here too, because when we fit the orbit for that, we found it was almost the same as groups A and B. So kind of coincidentally got lucky, and this all sort of seems to be the same structure. It also fits really well with what we fit in density for the perpendicular stream. So we plotted all the stream centers on this plot, and there's a cyan line hidden underneath here that fits so well you can hardly see it underneath the other points. So we were pretty happy that we were able to recover the perpendicular stream just by independently looking at several of these moving groups from Dufaux's 2014 Quest RLI race. So this n-body simulation here is run with 10 to the 7th solar masses, a scale radius of 0.4, and 2 gigayears of integration time. I believe the galactic potential that we used was a Hernquist bulge, a Miyamoto Nagai disk, and a logarithmic halo. If you'd like more information about which halo or galactic potential we used, it's from a Newberg 2010 paper. The model is model number 5. This is just this one set of three moving groups here. And then we decided, you know, we were doing all the other moving groups, so I'll show them here as well. Group F seems to match very well with our parallel stream, Tony Sohn's parallel stream, as well as Carlin's Virgo stellar stream. So again, this was sort of another independent fit where we ended up recovering another structure that we were previously seeing in the Virgo overdensity. So finally, we have group D, which seems to be very similar to the group A, A, B, and H one, except just on a lower energy. So if you see, especially in the distance plots, this one goes out to about a distance of, say, 30 kiloparsecs, and instead this one goes out to a distance of maybe 10. And again, we're getting back into this picture of we have one merger maybe going through the center of the galaxy, instantly being tidally disrupted by the center of the galaxy, and then being dispersed in its energies and put on orbits with a whole bunch or a range of different energies and distances in their final orbits. So what we did is we then tried to fit all of these simultaneously with another n-body simulation. To do this, we had to increase the mass of the dwarf galaxy that we sent in, as well as the scale radius, and we used the same 2 gigayear integration time. See here it looks sort of like a mess. But if we look at this back in kinematic space, where we're looking at, in this case, it's VGSR and number count, in slices by distance, we see that we're now able to recover the two horns of Virgo that Heidi was seeing in her 2007 paper. And then as you go further out in distance in the same direction of Virgo, you now come up with something that has a central hump in the middle, which would be indicative of the apogalactican, or I guess in this case, aphelion of the substructure that we're looking at. So after we did all of this with the small subset of the DuFo data, we decided to look at the bigger subset of the Vivas data from 2016. And what we found is that when we plot all of the orbits that we fit over here, you can kind of come up with just sort of something that fills this entire space and accounts for all of the points that they found in their, or all of the moving groups that they found in their moving group fits. So this is extremely interesting. In the background, you can see in these magenta points, this is a subsample of the points from our N-body in the same direction. And we are, again, with the N-body, able to fill up all of the points in here. More interestingly, out in the distant areas here, we're still finding points out to 60 kiloparsecs for Virgo. So this Virgo radial merger is able to spew stuff so far out into the halo that we're actually finding stuff that's sort of coincident with what they thought was Sagittarius. Now, when we look at the energy angular momentum plots again, we see that there's a distinct difference between what we see as this central low angular momentum Virgo radial merger that we're calling it, and then this different higher angular momentum part, which is likely the Sagittarius stream. So that is very promising that what we're seeing is two separate things here. So what happens if you look at all of the stars from the Virgo radial merger in the location of the solar neighborhood? So I believe this is within 5 kiloparsecs of the sun. We end up reproducing almost exactly the Gaia sausage, or Gaia Enceladus mergers. And so we're suggesting maybe that these could be from the same event, or maybe we'll have to come up with some other way to show that there's maybe two mergers or something that came in on radial orbits, which seems maybe slightly less likely, but I don't know. So this is not a new idea that Virgo is some radial structure. In Yulia Simeon's paper from this year, she found that Hercules Aquila cloud and the Virgo overdensity were both seemingly on these very radial orbits. I don't believe she fit any N-bodies in her paper, but we are now introducing a whole group of N-bodies that kind of show and corroborate this idea that Hercules Aquila, Virgo, and this radial structure are probably all very connected. So what are the implications of the Virgo radial merger? So these are some questions I just kind of think of off the top of my head. What would a 10 to the 9th solar mass merger passing through the galactic center 2 gigayears ago do to the bar, the disk, or the bulge? And if you ask Minchiev in 2009 or Dongia's 2016 paper, where they actually try playing around with, exciting some kind of wave patterns or doing other disk simulations and passing things close to the center of the galaxy, you do excite interesting features in the disk, but you don't destroy the disk. So that's, it doesn't rule out the fact that something could have actually passed through the galactic center 2 gigayears ago. How much does the mass distribution of the galactic center affect our N-body simulations? Now, that's a good open question. We're not exactly sure. Basically, these things are coming within, 1 or 2 kiloparsecs of the galactic center when they're colliding with the Milky Way. So there's probably a strong influence that the galactic center will have on the eventual orbits and energy distribution of these particles and stars. And the final question I have is it possible to have the Gaia-Enceladus merger or the Gaia-Sausage merger and a Virgo-radial merger, or do they have to be from the same merger? And if you decide they have to be from the same merger, how do you reconcile the fact that the Gaia-Enceladus and Gaia-Sausage merger are claimed to be, from 10 gigayears ago, and we're able to reproduce this with an N-body that has collided only 2 gigayears ago? I don't have an answer to that question. So here are my conclusions, and I will take questions.
Thank you, Jake. So, questions?
Yeah.
You mentioned this, but I think I missed it. Mm-hmm. What is the galactic potential you are using?
It's a Hernquist bulge, a Miyamoto Nagai disk, and a logarithmic halo. If you'd like the actual parameters, it's from the Newberg 2010 paper. It's model number 5. You can also get it from Tom's paper. It's up on archive now. It's downloaded all. Yeah.
I mean, one question and then actually an answer to one of the questions that you put out on your slide. But first, a question: how do you set up your n-body models? Sort of, what I'm actually interested in is like how do you actually generate your initial conditions? Because you know it seems like you're considering orbits that are actually fairly inside the Milky Way, and so do you take into account you know what happens when a galaxy is supposed to you know cross the virial radius, and then get all the way down to the present day. So you know you're talking about something that happened 2 giga years ago, but it could also be that you know the merger happened much longer. I mean, it started much longer ago, and, right. and that you're you know probably seeing something of a remain.
So we take a pretty naive kind of approach where we take our orbit that we have, assuming that it's going to end up in Virgo, and we integrate backwards through our potential for 2 giga years, and then we put a Plummer sphere distribution with the scale radius and mass that I had had said for whichever n-body you want, and then we just integrate forward in time and then compare at the end.
Right. And then actually, well, just can you go back to the slide about the... Yeah, so for, you know, just a comment, you know, there's... Actually, nothing's going to really happen with a 10 to the 9 solar mass halo. Actually, there's a paper by Feldman and Spoliar. They simulate basically impacts with sort of something that's actually you know 10 to the 9 to 10 to the 8. Generally, what happens is that you don't actually create very strong density perturbations, but you do create sort of some small velocity perturbations. But then they quickly dissipate, and so you know my feeling is that because we know that Sagittarius must have been you know quite high mass, you know this signal probably is there, but is mm-hmm. is totally buried under the
right.
under the larger stuff. So I don't think so. And then the mean chef model was actually just a test particle mm-hmm. simulation. There wasn't really anything realistic about the initial conditions. It was just shifting a Gaussian and then letting it phase mix. So.
Yeah, but that's like sort of the worst case scenario, right? You have something extremely dense punching directly through the center of the galaxy, kind of.
Yeah, but you know, we live in the real world.
Right,
so,
yeah,
you
yeah.
know, like,
of course.
Yeah.
Robin? Jake, so it's really cool to see that this, you've found like the first shell in the Milky Way that I would believe is a shell. So I thought it was really interesting that you looked at the variation of the velocity distribution as a function of distance and saw this this change from this two like bimodal to single modal profile, which is exactly what you see even in sort of the analytical models of shells that I used to play with as a grad student / young postdoc, and the variation of the delta V between those horns as a function of distance is itself a measure of the local gravitational force.
Oh.
So going back to this this question of the timing, another thing that you might look at is whether the estimate you get from the shell itself is consistent with the enclosed mass in the model you're using to integrate the orbit. Because somebody pointed this out when we were discussing this last week at the Gaia Sprint, and I can't remember who, so I apologize. But the main thing, like setting the timing of this, is the mass distribution, like the overall normalization,
right?
So I just thought it might be interesting to see whether you see any consistency there.
Thank you,
Katri.
Yeah, so to follow on from here, I guess the Hercules Aquila also shows the double peaked, as Julia showed. Yeah, so it actually kind of matches up this idea of matching both sides.
So one of the things I didn't mention real quick is that this side over here actually matches up really well with the Hercules Aquila cloud.
So I guess my question is, to what extent, because you're looking at main sequence turnoff, to what extent are we sure that there aren't, and maybe this is a question also for Vitaly, are we sure that there aren't shells further out? Because the multiple groups you're seeing suggest you're seeing multiple passages in and out, which are associated with multiple shells, which will get mixed up with the distance. But maybe there are, my anticipation, going to Sherman's comment, I would anticipate that it's there's more debris further out at a larger radius that maybe we're not looking at.
Yeah, it would be hard to see that, I think, right? But
yeah. Oh, sorry.
Vasily?
What did you know
this? I mean, we don't have any data out that far, right? We were just using what was available in the VIVIS data, but maybe with...
So I think we looked for further shells, and it's difficult to see without radial velocities. But just to point out that the shells, we interpreted them as a natural consequence of the merger 10 giga-years ago, which would leave behind shells like this.
Yeah.
So... And we, of course, started looking for the outer shells to prove the or to test how the merger proceeded and what happened to the progenitor. So is it because you want to say something?
Yeah, I had another thought.
Okay, cool.
I think for both of you. So actually looking for the outer shells, and maybe if it's, maybe you can both comment on this. You'd find out which was the most distant, which way the orbit's going, and which is the most distant, Virgo or Hercules Aquila, and then you'd integrate further back. And it might not actually be at the same angle, right? Because it might have processed.
Right.
So I don't know to what extent. So anyway.
Sherwin?
Yeah, so you also brought up the idea of like perhaps two mergers, and I think there's been other people also like, you know, advocating for things like that. For example, Diedrich had a paper with this, and I was wondering, like, have you thought of like looking at like, you know, sort of the different globular clusters that, for example, Diedrich, you know, associated with his Kraken thing, I think Canis Major is dead, but you know, he wants to bring it back, so let's bring it back. But have you tried looking at sort of how the globular clusters fall on some of your in-body models?
No. We have not looked at the globular clusters, but I guess this brings up an open question that I sort of have and Heidi sort of has. We're able to fit, even after you remove all of this substructure, that there's still some flattening to the halo. And maybe that flattening is caused by some ancient merger that is really well phase mixed now, but has, you know, again, either gone close to the center or caused some type of tilt to the overall halo density, which could be interesting, or flattening to the halo density.
Can I ask a very technical question?
Yeah.
So the turnoff stars at 90 kiloparsecs, magnitude 23.5, 24, that you shouldn't really be seeing them.
Right.
So what are you fitting for the trailing?
So, I mean, if you think about the way that our model works, right, we don't actually have to see all of the stars in the Gaussian that we're fitting. We can fit some tail and then set the center out and say that the distribution comes in and creates some tail that would have to have some type of center out this far. That's part of the reason why our distance uncertainties are so large there, because we are fitting the tail of some Gaussian with this thing. So we don't have to have the center of our stream be within our limits of our magnitude limits for our stars to be able to fit it.
Okay, I have two more questions.
Vasily.
Made me think of this other question, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So the scale, for your Hohlenquist, you must be fitting a scale length as well as a...
Right.
And what was... You didn't
tell
us how much that varied.
We actually left the scale length constant. So in previous iterations of this work, Newby had allowed it to vary. And he fit something that was pretty close to about 12 kiloparsecs. And we found that by varying the scale length, it really didn't, over the region that we were concerned with, change the density profile too much. So we just picked a nice middle ground, which was the 12 kiloparsecs that Newby seemed to be able to fit, and kind of just went with that, just to reduce the number of parameters that we were fitting in our overall model and make it a little bit easier for our optimization algorithms.
And I guess my other question was, why three streams, and did you play with that?
Okay, so that is a good question, and we have since played with that. So when we go back to this picture here, right, we thought that we'd only really be sensitive to the biggest structures here, the major ones being the Sagittarius North bright and faint, and then this Virgo overdensity. So we wanted to make sure we had a component for each of these things. In the end, we think that maybe we do need to fit one or two more streams in some of these cases, and I've gone back and I've looked at using Bayesian information criterion to try and decide whether or not you're fitting too many streams or too few streams or if you need another stream. And the result of that was not fully fleshed out, because I was sort of running out of time. But I think the idea was that three streams was okay. Four streams for some of these was better, but not for all of them. So there is a question still of what the best way to determine the right number of streams is for this fitting out method. But it's still clearly finding things. So this is at least good enough for now, and then we'll maybe try and implement some way to determine how many streams want to fit. And the bigger concern, I think, in my mind for the streams question is whether or not a Gaussian cylinder is a good enough model for something we now know has shells in it. And I think we might want to go back and revisit the density model that we're using for our streams in light of the fact that we now know that there is this big radial structure that will definitely not look like a cylinder in our model, so, or in the data. So,
Jim?
Have you thought about trying to apply the same type of fitting stream, or I guess I don't know how you'd call it, Gaussian cylinder fitting to deeper data in the north, like the legacy surveys or even DES in the south?
So yeah, it should be like not too difficult to implement something that would allow this to fit the new data. The hard part would be you'd have to go back and redo all of your selection function criteria. So we haven't done it, but it's something that could be done with this modeling. Yeah.
Cool.
So have you tested how vulnerable the less stream-like results like shell are to changes in the metallicity profile of the halo? Because if I look at your cluster calibration, I see, of course, at the same age, there is a very wide spread. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that the globular cluster age metallicity relation can save you when it comes to a potential gradient of metallicity into the halo?
We haven't looked at that. This was work done before I started working on the project. So I just kind of took at face value that this age metallicity relationship would work. And you know, we have done some modeling where we've looked at how robust our algorithm was to fitting, even if we had like the wrong density profile, for example. And we're still able to recover streams. So I would imagine small variations in the absolute magnitude distribution would again also not affect things too much.
So and mm-hmm.
Right.
Right. Possibly
right, yeah. Well, I mean, we already know that our model's not great for shells to begin with, so you know, we'll have to see in the end what model we decide to go with if we decide to continue trying to do model fitting like this for density with shells.
Okay.
Okay, so one of the parameters of your model is like per field how wide the Gaussian cylinder is that you're using to model the stream, right? So do you see a variation in the width of the perpendicular stream as a function of distance along it?
So we only have like four or five stream centers in the perpendicular stream. And if I remember correctly, they're all pretty similar within, you know, one or two KPC of the width. I can't remember, but if you look at my 2018 paper, you will see it has a whole table of what all of the widths are and all the different parameters for all of these things are. So you could go and you could look there and it would give you a better thing than what I can remember off the top of my head.
If you think it's like the handle of the umbrella, mm-hmm. then you kind of expect that it should
right.
widen a little bit as you get further away in distance.
If you're doing something opposite, right, in the Bulbert's paper, mm-hmm. it kind of shows the opposite.
Sorry. Right in the plot that you showed
right,
from
yeah,
Douglas's
it kinda goes
paper,
a different
it's
way.
Broader at the bottom and narrow at the top.
I think part of the problem is that we're looking at it from like a heliocentric viewpoint, so you're not. It's kind of hard to get the projection of it right where you might see that type of thing in this type of. Yeah. Well, that's why we started doing the N bodies to try and get a better handle of what's going on. And actually, if you look at the N bodies, I have a video I can show people offline if you'd like. of this actual N-body simulation. You can see it kind of shooting out from the galactic center. It's really interesting.
Okay, thanks, Jake, again.